You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hi, and welcome to SpyCast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, the museum brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. Join us as we take a closer look at the secret world of intelligence. The following is a recording of a live program held at the International Spy Museum. For more information about upcoming programs at the museum, please visit spymuseum.org. And on the middle of our homepage, you can check out the calendar of all the great events that are coming up soon. Today's SpyCast is brought to you by our friends at Mack Weldon. Mack Weldon is reinventing men's basics, smart design, premium fabrics, and simple shopping. Thank you for your continued support of SpyCast.
We are incredibly pleased today to have with us Cadi Marton. Is that right?
Yeah.
Ah! I give you... YouTube, she's been interviewed all over the place, and there are 20 different pronunciations of her name, and so I was a little stressed about it. Mm-hmm. So a little biography here. Cadi was born in Hungary, and she has a career as a reporter and a writer with human rights advocacy. From 03 to 08, she chaired the International Women's Health Coalition, a global leader in promoting and protecting the health and human rights of women and girls. From 01 to 02, she was chief advocate for the Office of Special Representative for Children in Armed Conflict at the United Nations. She's also served as the director and chair of the Committee to Protect Journalists, as well as on the Human Rights Watch Board for more than a decade. She also serves as a board of directors on the board of directors of the International Rescue Committee, New America, and Central European University. She's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, PEN International, and the Authors Guild. Since 1980, Cadi has published 9 books and contributed as reported to ABC News, Public Broadcasting Service, I don't know why I didn't say PBS there, National NPR, The New Yorker, Atlantic Monthly, The Times of London, The Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal, and many, many more. Her 2009 book, a Cold War memoir entitled Enemies of the People, My Family's Journey to America, which is also published by Simon & Schuster, was a National Book Critics Circle finalist. Her newest book, and what we're here to talk about today, is True Believer, Stalin's Last American Spy, which is a fascinating tale of espionage and Cold War intrigue. So thank you, Cadi, for taking the time to join us here at the International Spy Museum.
Thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be here and wonderful to see so many spy followers.
More here than you'll ever see.
Yes.
Your new book is a biography of a man named Noel Field, who is not as well known as many of his colleagues in both the U.S. government, but also in the spy world, such as Alger Hiss. Can you give us a little bit of an introduction to Noel Field as
sure.
a man?
Yes. Well, he should be better known than any of them because he, in some ways he did more damage than Alger Hiss or even Kim Philby. So Noel Hiss was the son of a deeply rooted Yankee family. They settled in New England in the 17th century. So he was really an American aristocrat, third-generation Harvard grad, a brilliant young man who aced Harvard four-year program in 2 years with a great career ahead of him, but a man who felt somehow alienated from his environment, having landed a... very much sought-after position at the State Department in the Office of Western European Affairs at age 21. He was set for a huge career. Unbeknownst to him, the Kremlin was talent scouting for people just like Noel, with precisely his profile and precisely his natural built-in cover. And what spies most need is a cover.
We talk a lot about motivations here at the Spy Museum. Whenever you're trying to think of why somebody chooses to commit treason, it's always difficult to drag that out. And we use the acronym MICE here at the museum. It's a way to kind of simplify and understand that a little bit. MICE is telling motivations. One is money. M is money. I is ideology. Mm-hmm. C is compromise or coercion. Mm-hmm. And E is ego. Seems like it's pretty clear where Noel falls on this spectrum. Can you talk a little bit about his motivation?
Sure. Well, it certainly wasn't money. Noel was a kind of a dreamy idealist. And one of the significant takeaways from True Believer is that it isn't enough just to want to do good in the world, as he desperately did want to do. You also have to have judgment, which he desperately lacked. So Noel Field was living in Washington, D.C. at a time very much like our time. That is to say, the country was deeply divided. He was of a generation that really had lost faith in politics and politicians' ability to right wrongs, to correct the social injustices. Sound familiar, right? An alienated class of well-educated people who really made a very rich target for the enemy that was as of yet invisible, the enemy that was in Moscow. And in those days, of course, what we knew of the newly formed Soviet Union, we knew from Soviet propaganda. And this was obviously the days before the internet, but the Soviet spin machine was as adept and as cunning in picking out targets of opportunity for recruitment to espionage as ISIS is today.
Well, and you can see how the Soviets had a very fertile ground with the United States in the 1920s and 30s. The Great Depression, you'd come out of World War I, which seemed to be a huge mistake for the United States. You have the marches of the Bonus Army, people not doing very well. And then you have this utopian ideal, like you talked about, where there's no anti-Semitism, there's no racism, everybody's got a job, everybody's got food. And for intellectuals like Field, who were, let's admit, pretty socially awkward, and we really, you know...
Well, that's a big part of it, Vince, is the alienation, which at Harvard was very conspicuous. He was not a cool guy on campus. He was a geek. He was a super geek. He lived at home. These things may sound trivial, but they aren't. Not when you have a very shrewd enemy that has talent spotters in the field looking for alienated young people, very much like today, and looking for, it isn't enough just for a young man or a young woman to be alienated. You also have to want to be part of something bigger than yourself, part of something important historically, and that is where, you know, the ego comes in.
Right.
This was a man with a very weak ego, and who was really just searching for utopia. And it's very easy to sell a utopia if the actual utopia is the opposite, but is so far away that, I mean, again, like today, Syria today, or any other ISIS-held territory. It's very easy to sell to somebody who is dreaming of righting every wrong, who is surrounded by jobless people and by a very racist society. One of the interesting things about Noel Field is how complicated a character he is, because he has so many good qualities, and it just shows that good qualities can be twisted to evil purpose.
He's somebody who's desperately searching for a sense of belonging somewhere. He's not finding it at Harvard. He's not finding it at the State Department. No. And there's the possibility of potentially finding it with for lack of a better term, fellow travelers who were working for the Soviet Union.
Right, but to differentiate Noel Field from fellow travelers is very important because there were many fellow travelers and, you know, sort of vaguely idealistic, socially conscious people who saw that this was, we are talking about the period in American history right before President Roosevelt. Of course, President Roosevelt, you know, came to Washington and injected the place with hope and with energy and the New Deal, et cetera, and job creation. But this was not the case under President Hoover, who, when hundreds of thousands of veterans of World War I came marching down Pennsylvania Avenue, padlocked the gates to the White House and refused to see them. And Noel Field, my hero or anti-hero, marched with them. And that gave him the first good feeling about himself, that feeling of being part of something bigger than himself, of being in the stream of history, and the relief that this tormented young man, tormented by insecurity and guilt feelings because he was born into privilege and surrounded by misery with 11 million American unemployed. So he was just ripe for picking. And unfortunately, the man who might have steered him toward a more moderate life of good deeds, his father, enormously important figure for him, died suddenly when Noel was 17 years old. And but died right after he took his son to the battlefields of World War I, to the Marne and to Verdun, which of course were mass graves. In those days, especially, the graves were virtually fresh. You know, thousands of young men who had fallen for what? For several meters of territory. And the father said to the son, "Son, make sure it doesn't happen again." And so Noel Field takes that to heart. And so he wants to be part of some sort of a revolutionary movement that promises to right every wrong. And the United States is not that country.
Wait, you look at one of the major events of the 1930s that continues to radicalize many people who would later spy for the Soviet Union, that most Americans don't think a lot about because we weren't involved in, and that's the Spanish Civil War.
Big event in Noel's life and in my book. It's really a big chapter because that is where the West had the first opportunity to do something other than talk big about the rise of fascism and to actually fight fascism. And Mussolini and Hitler were heavily engaged arming Franco's, the fascist Spanish forces. And once again, the United States was on the sidelines. And Noel Field was present in Spain because we're fast-forwarding a bit here. But he always had scruples about spying in his own country. Didn't prevent him from spying. It didn't prevent him from stealing documents from the State Department or giving full briefings on conferences to his Soviet minder. But in Spain, he had left the State Department, which made this man more anxious even than he normally was, and joined the League of Nations, where he continued to spy. But at least there it was a slightly more ambiguous kind of spying. He was spying on everybody for Moscow, as opposed to just on his own country. So he had been sent to Spain to the Spanish Civil War to help repatriate the fallen fallen mostly socialist left leaning fighters from Spain to their countries, and this is to their eternal anguish. This is where Noel Field met the future leaders of the Soviet bloc, and that would prove their downfall because ultimately, a single meeting with Noel Field turned out to be lethal.
One of the extraordinary transformations in this book is Field from a young, peace-loving, you know, talking to Alan Dulles and others about, I'm going to bring peace to the world, to later on becoming very hardened
Yes.
You know, where he assisted in the assassination of his handler, a friend. He kind of, as his compatriots keep getting purged one after the other, it kind of just steals his resolve. And then there's a moment where many of his contemporaries gave up on the utopian ideal of the Soviet Union. That's the Nazi-Soviet Pact, where many people who had been seduced by the Soviet Union said, oh, they're just like everybody else. I no longer
only
am.
Only worse.
Only worse, right? I'm no longer a someone who subscribes to this idea. It was opposite for him. He had been fully indoctrinated, brainwashed into this idea. And you have a great line in the book where it's actually in the introduction, so you don't have to go too far to read it. It says that Field had the gift for seeing only what he chooses to see.
Yes.
And that just seemed so prescient to me. The idea is just...
Yes.
It was always an excuse. There was always a way that Stalin was doing it the right way, even when he was killing everybody around him.
The party could do no wrong. Yeah. Well, it's like any religious faith. Once you embrace it wholeheartedly, your entire life depends on it because it gives your life purpose and meaning. It gives you comrades, so a sense of family. Right. And therefore you are willing to betray your own family, which I think one of the most terrifying things about Noel Field is how he crushed his own family for the cause, in quotation marks, for the greater good of communism. He and his wife, who I have a quote from somebody saying that she would have followed him whether he chose to be a Buddhist monk or a killer, so it was his wife was a full partner in treachery and paid for it as well. But they really decided not to have children because that would have been a diversion from the cause. I mean, talk about fanaticism. But you know, this week particularly, we as a New Yorker, we're very much conscious of self-radicalized terrorist killers. Well, Noel Field, from a prior era, was self-radicalized because he started down this road of fanaticism and really being a tool of a murderous branch of fanaticism, which is what Stalinism was, on his own. Reading whatever he could get his hands on about the Russian Revolution and the great Marxist tomes, and inhaling it, and as some inhale the Bible or the Quran, and so that by the time the KGB came knocking on his door, he was ready. But as with the New York bomber. The road to radicalization began as a very private matter. Late at night, when he would get home from the State Department, he lived his real life, as he called it, and the time he put in the State Department became less and less significant. And the deeper he went into the printed texts. And the remarkable thing is that here's this brilliant young man and many others of his generation as well who could trust a country, a faith, an ideology, I'm talking about the Soviet ideology, without ever having set foot in that country. And so from afar, they inhaled the message, which was a beautiful message, a utopian image of every injustice righted and leveled.
But even when it wasn't a utopian message anymore, even when he was introduced directly to the reality of the situation, after the war, he has essentially a nightmarish situation. He worked with OSS during the war, working with the resistance groups, which heavily worked with OSS. And after the war, it was the Hiss versus Chambers trial that essentially destroyed his spy life. Whitaker Chambers, while testifying against Alger Hiss, also names Noel Field as a spy for the Soviet Union.
Which ends his double life. In one morning, he picks up the New York Times, and he is the headline, unmasked. And of course, now he's a desperate man.
Right.
And let me just say, Vince, that he was never a brilliant spy. he was a committed one, but he the material that he stole was not on par with the Rosenbergs. He did not steal any atomic secrets. He stole things that were in a State Department that was very sloppy and very naive. It was the State Department of gentlemen don't read other gentlemen's mail, famous right. quote from a Secretary of State. And therefore, it was pretty light work stealing documents from the State Department. And let me just also add that the FBI, under J. Edgar Hoover, who became, of course, one of the most zealous red witch hunters, in those days was also not very interested in communist penetration. We are talking about an era which represents the high watermark of Soviet penetration of the highest reaches of the United States government, the White House, the Treasury, and the State Department. By the time J. Edgar Hoover began his witch hunt, which of course led to the shameful McCarthyist era, there were very few witches left right. in the woods. But while my guy, Noel Field, was working, the woods were full of witches.
Right, in the 30s, that would have been a target-rich environment for Hoover, but he waits a little too long.
He does. And that perhaps accounts for his excessive zeal right. in hunting them well past their sell-by date.
So when Field is exposed as a spy, this sadly coincides with when Stalin is looking for an excuse
yes.
to round up and liquefy all of the people who had worked for him loyally the last several decades but had been exposed to the West. Kind of the second great purge yeah. in the Soviet Union
yes.
after 1938. You talk a little bit about this story, because this is really kind of, this is where he does his damage. As you mentioned,
yeah.
it wasn't as a spy, it was as something far, far more
yeah.
sinister.
Well, Stalin had a very successful run in the 30s, purging his perceived rivals for Lenin's mantle with show trials that had absolutely no connection to justice. They were as much propaganda tools as ISIS beheadings are today. They were meant to inspire fear and terror, and did so. Now he takes Stalin in his last years of advanced paranoia. His target is Titoists, because Tito, the popular and heroic head of the Yugoslav Communist Party, is too independent for Stalin's taste. So in full rage, Stalin can't move against Tito. But he can move against all the other satellites in the Soviet zone, because there he has his troops still in occupation. And he needs somebody who knows all the heads of these newly established satellites and who can connect them to the new enemy, namely Washington. Because you mentioned that Noel Field worked for Wild Bill Donovan's outfit, mm-hmm. the OSS, which he thought that as a good communist and a good communist spy was what the Kremlin would want him to do, because Uncle Joe famously was allied with FDR in defeating Hitler, but he did not clear this work. This was kind of freelance work. He did not clear it with Moscow, because wartime communications made that impossible. So now Stalin has in Noel Field his slavish servant of many years, a man who can indict all the communists of espionage for Alan Dulles and the CIA, the newly formed CIA, and strike a blow against Titoists. And so this man is a dream come true for the Kremlin. And so they lure him with a fake job offer. They lure this desperate Noel Field, desperate now because he can't come home. He can't. He's been unmasked. So he, sort of like Edward Snowden, he rushes east for sanctuary. Is kidnapped from his hotel in Prague. Drugged when he regains consciousness, he finds himself in a very strange country whose language he does not understand. The multilingual Noel Field does not understand.
I was going to jokingly say no one but you seems to understand.
I admit, I had a definite edge in researching this because I do speak Budapest born and I do speak the language. And luckily for me, the surveillance records are in Hungarian and in the secret police archives in Budapest, where I know my way around from prior work.
We will come back to our program momentarily. But first, if you've been listening to SpyCast over the last couple of weeks, you've heard me talk about Mack Weldon. And if you're like me, when you started your first job and you barely had enough money for rent, ramen, and an NFL Sunday ticket, you bought most of your clothes at big department store or retail store for as cheaply as you could. Now that I'm an adult, at least in age, I try to buy clothes at places that also don't sell Funyuns and scented candles. Although Funyuns and scented candles are awesome, especially Funyun scented candles. While I matured in my sensibilities when it came to dress shirts, shoes, and pants, I still shop for the basics at the same place I shop for cat food and shampoo. Does this sound familiar? Well, no matter what store-bought brands you've been using in the past, Mack Weldon is better than whatever you're wearing right now. And will be the most comfortable underwear, socks, shirts, undershirts, hoodies, shorts, polos, and sweatpants that you will ever own. The cool thing about this company is that they're constantly growing. If you went online to check out Mack Weldon after hearing my first read a couple months ago, and then never looked again, you'll be amazed at how much more they have to offer. This includes everyday socks that you treat your feet right. Sharply designed and tech-enhanced, these stay put as you keep moving. A cushioned footbed makes for undeniably comfortable wear, no matter how much pavement you're pounding. And for fans of the discreet, they are the no-show socks, which stay out of sight and slip free with smart design and built-in gel strip technology. A seamless toe and extra cushioned footbed keeps things comfortable. And these are ideal for sneakers and dress shoes. And of course, Mack Weldon will always have the try-on guarantee, hassle-free returns, and free shipping on orders over $50. Mack Weldon is reinventing men's basics. Smart design, premium fabrics, and simple shopping. So go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off using the promo code SPYCAST. That's MackWeldon.com and get 20% off using the promo code SPYCAST.
One thing I found interesting and almost frustrating when I was reading about this was Field comes across as almost in a kind of an abusive relationship,
yes,
where he's constantly just, you know, beaten and I'm trying not to curse here. He was made, he was just beaten and abused and abused and abused and abused,
yes,
by the Soviet regime. And every time he comes
tortured,
back.
Tortured, horribly,
right,
tortured.
And he doesn't come back for more, but
he
justifies the abuse. He says, I deserved it.
He has
my
a martyr.
Fault. It was,
he has a martyr complex. Yeah. As much as I allow myself to indulge in amateur psychiatry, he was definitely there's a bit of a masochist in him, and he's looking to suffer for the great cause, and he, you know, tragically where most of the other right thinking members of his generation, people like George Orwell and Arthur Kessler and Edmund Wilson and you name it, a whole generation of fellow travelers, saw the light eventually. Noel Field never did. And even after he was tortured, there was always a Soviet agent in the room when he was being interrogated by Hungarian secret policemen. So he could have no doubt that the orders for this sham judicial he was never tried. But his name in court, frequently uttered, was enough to guarantee a death sentence for those,
right,
with whom he came in contact, mostly during the Spanish Civil War.
Well, one thing that's extraordinary is it's not just about masochism, in my opinion, because he dragged his whole family into it as well.
Terrible.
And
yes,
his wife is in prison for several,
yes,
years. And what was fascinating to me was when he finally is reunited with his wife.
Yes.
He asked her, did you stay true? And at first I'm like, I doubt she's going to be having affairs in prison.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Not what he was getting at. What was he actually asking her?
He was asking, did you stay true to our cause? And can you imagine reunited with his wife, who he had made suffer unspeakable horrors, as well as his younger brother, who went looking for him, an eminent Boston-based architect, Herman Field, also in yet another way station of the Gulag Archipelago. And last but not least, the heroine of this tale, his adopted daughter, Erica. Erica Wallach I had the best time writing and researching Erica, because she is the kind of heroine that you only read about in fiction. She is such a cool lady. And she goes looking for her stepfather because she feels that Washington has completely forgotten him. I mean, just imagine a family of four Americans just vanishes. And very little is being done. Of course, it was understandable that not that much was done on Noel's behalf, because Noel had been unmasked as a spy. Still, but there was his brother and his wife and his daughter. But so Erica takes it upon, a very determined young woman, goes looking for him, and is rewarded with 5 years in the northernmost outpost of the Gulag Archipelago, the Arctic, Forkuta, where she lays railroad tracks. And so we are now at the end of their prison ordeal, which is ended not because anybody in the East suddenly has a stroke of humanity.
Well, it ends because someone in the East had a stroke.
Yeah. And it wasn't humanity.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, not only Stalin's death, but this is 2 years after Stalin's death. The irony is that their interrogator of the whole family, interrogator, which is a euphemism for torturer, defects. This is a real Le Carré-esque plot twist. He uses a shopping trip to Berlin and turns up at the American embassy and asks for political asylum. So the CIA spends a year debriefing this man, and then stages a big news conference here in Washington, and he announces to the world that the family, this American family, are alive, and I know where they are because I was their interrogator. So now the State Department starts bombarding Moscow with memoranda saying, we want to know what happened to the family. And now it's Khrushchev making nice with Eisenhower. Right. And so they are freed. But Noel Field, having been unmasked as a spy, is in no mood to face the music back here. So he asks for political asylum in the country that has held him prisoner for 5 years, he and his wife, which is a huge political gain in the East-West chess game. I'm not a chess player, so what is it when all the pieces go your way? Anyway,
it's checkmate.
It's checkmate. Yeah. It's checkmate for Moscow. This high value. Former spy is now asked, choosing East over West. But one of the conditions of his release is that he never talk to Western media about his ordeal, which would, of course, not make Moscow look too good. And this is where my personal story intersects.
I found, again, the idea of indoctrination is, when he got out of prison, when he was released, he had no idea about the outside world.
No.
And he was so cut off from everyone else.
He'd been in solitary.
Right, he'd been in solitary confinement. Yeah. He asked about Stalin and found out he had died a year earlier, two years earlier, and he sobbed.
Yes. How about that? So, I mean, if that's not proof of the depth of the man's fanaticism, and that this really was like a fundamentalist religion, and the death of the caliph, the prophet, the Messiah, all in one. And he was crushed, even though he knew that Stalin was responsible for his family's ordeal. But he considered it, when he asks for his case to be reinvestigated, because he didn't like being known as a CIA agent when he was so deeply of the other faith, if you will. He doesn't do that for his own record. He does it because he thinks that his case reflects badly on the Soviets. So that is the power and the depth of the brainwashing that he has been through, and that for the rest of his life, even though now he is living in a Soviet-controlled state. A Soviet-controlled state, which is about to erupt in revolution, a genuine popular uprising, and he is there, but he is so blinded by his faith and for Noel Field, believing is seeing, not the other way around. He considers the Hungarian Revolution as a counter-revolution, and he considers the Soviet forces that come in to extinguish that revolution very brutally. He considers that the real revolution.
Right.
Those are the real freedom fighters,
right.
The Soviet troops who came in and put out the Hungarian uprising.
So so far we've kept something from the audience that I think adds a wonderful wrinkle to this story. You and your family, well, you were very, very young, but your family especially were closely involved in not just this case.
It's a strange
yeah.
intersection. So when I was a little kid in growing up in Budapest, my mother and father were the only free media covering the unfolding Sovietization of Hungary. And they covered the arrest of Noel Field and the show trials that followed. And when Noel Field was freed, they immediately asked to interview him. My father was the AP correspondent, my mother UPI. And until then, as a precondition of his release, he had sworn that he would never talk to the Western media. And the American ambassador in Hungary had kept Field's address a secret. But once Field asks for political asylum from the Soviets and their Hungarian puppets, the ambassador tells Field, "I will no longer protect your privacy. I will give the Martons your address, my parents." And days after that, my father is arrested, grabbed in the middle of the night, and taken to the same prison where Noel Field just was. Not only the same prison,
not only that, yeah.
The same cell. So when the jailer leads my father, my journalist father, to his cell, he says to him, "Congratulations, you got the VIP cell, recently vacated by an American agent named Noel Field." So 2 years later, my father is freed, and he tells us this story and also adds that, by the way, VIP cell didn't mean I had a river view. It meant that I had more sophisticated bugs in my cell than anybody else. And then during the chaos of the Hungarian uprising, my parents locate the Fields and conduct the one and only press interview with Mr. and Mrs. Field. And I think that it was surprise that got them past the front door. I think they were so shocked to see. They knew exactly who my parents were, of course, because my parents had a lot of publicity surrounding their arrest. And in fact, the first time that I was featured in the New York Times, my hometown paper, was a front page story of my parents' arrest because even by Soviet standards, it was particularly cruel to take both a mother and father of two little kids. So the first question that Mrs. Field asked my mother, who had also been in the same prison because they arrested both my parents, was what happened to the little girls? That would be me and my older sister. And it was a very kind of polite exchange. I write about it in the book. But then I found, and this is what makes research so much fun when you find something like this, I found a letter in the Hungarian archives that Noel wrote his friend Alger Hiss, just savaging my father. Imagine Alger, he didn't have the politeness to call ahead for an interview, as if he would have gotten an interview if he wouldn't have burst in on him like that. And he was very mad at my father for writing in his AP story that Field was a party man, because at that point he hadn't yet come out as a full-blown agent party man and wouldn't, because the Soviets felt that he was more useful to them as a propagandist who was a good American,
right,
and thought that America was a doomed state without having communist affiliation. So my father upset his plan. Yay, Dad.
Yes. Would you be willing to take some questions from the audience?
Oh, with pleasure, yes.
So we have a microphone coming around, so Shauna is there with it. So just raise your hand and she'll come to you. And
in True Believer, I found it very interesting to read about Varian Fry and about the interactions between Varian Fry and Noel Field.
Yes, if I may, just for those who may not be familiar with this wonderful Varian Fry, who was a great humanitarian who ran a rescue mission and during the Nazi occupation of France, at a time when the U.S. itself had a terrible history of non-rescue, Varian Fry was sort of a Raoul Wallenberg type of real humanitarian. And go on with your question.
What would you say throughout your research? What would you say that you found most meaningful about learning about Varian Fry and about the interactions between Varian Fry and Noel Field and about Varian Fry's rescue work?
Well, Varian Fry is the founder of the International Rescue Committee, which today, of course, is a giant and successful refugee operation, and I happen to serve on its board. Varian Fry was an early victim of the U.S. anti-immigrant, anti-refugee policy, which was shamefully in place during the Second World War, when we might have done far more to rescue, particularly Jews, but rescue was in the hands of an out-and-out anti-Semite, I would say, in the State Department named Breckinridge Long. But at any rate, Varian Fry meets Noel Field in Marseille, which is an important chapter in my book, What Happens in Marseille. And Varian Fry, ahead of almost everyone else, picks Noel Field out as what he is, a Soviet agent, and warns people off him. And at that point, Noel Field was living an absolutely clandestine life as a communist, and his own family didn't know that he was an agent. It was just assumed that he was, like so many other well-meaning people, you know, a leftist, socialist, do-gooder. And what, in fact, he was doing, Noel Field, was using money raised by a Boston NGO, the Unitarian Service Committee, and he turned it into, in his own words, red aid. So he was using the good people of Boston's hard-earned dollars meant to save anybody fleeing the Nazis to save only communists,
right.
and to help them repatriate to their countries of origin and to start setting up future communist states. Varian Fry was an early victim of this terrible chapter in American history. He was recalled to Washington because he was too successful. He saved a lot of really wonderful people, among them Marc Chagall, from the Nazis, and tried to warn both the United States about what it wasn't doing to help the refugees, and also to warn people about Noel Field long before anybody else. So I have nothing but respect for Varian Fry.
I was puzzled by your comment at the beginning. You felt that Field had done more damage, including Kim Philby. Now, as far as I can make out from the two-thirds of the book I've read and listening to you, all Fields did was he stole a bunch of memos in the 30s that probably weren't, in the longer scheme of things, such a big deal. And then during the war, he diverted a lot of resources to help communist refugees, all of whom went home and either got purged or shunted to the side, whereas Philby compromised all kinds of operations and God knows what else.
You know, it's hard to I probably shouldn't have said he did more damage than Philby, but let me just say that the human damage,
right,
that he committed, Noel Field, is beyond calculation. That his cruelty to his own family is something that surpassed anything that Philby did. But, you know, I don't like to play this.
It's hard to quantify. I mean,
it's like who was worse? You know, they were bad. They were bad, and we have reason enough to be critical and even contemptuous of both Field and Philby, who really sacrificed anybody who defied them and who got in the way of their ultimate cause. And the hundreds of people were led to their execution or imprisonment as a result of Noel Field's testimony. But it's hard to weigh. It's like when you're watching old films about Stalin and Hitler, you know, it's hard to, who do you root for?
It's more damage to what? Right?
Yes.
It's more damage,
yeah,
to Western intelligence. Kim Philby wins.
Yeah.
But more damage to the world. I mean, more damage to the people, the hundreds and hundreds that were killed. You can certainly have that. I think that's much more,
yeah,
in line.
But Philby, too, was a treacherous, contemptible character with different motives than Noel Field, I would say. But we're here to discuss Noel Field.
Yeah.
You mentioned cruelty to his own family. Was this simply a unfortunate consequence of his true Stalinist religion, mm-hmm, or, mm-hmm, actual acts of cruelty to his family members that went beyond the call of duty?
That's such a good question. I think it was just, he just didn't give a damn. I think he just, the evidence that he didn't give a damn about his family is when he tries to keep his brother Herman, who had already paid with his freedom for his brother Noel's sins by going in pursuit of him and then being jailed himself. He did not see his children for 5 years. He was in a horrible Warsaw dungeon. And yet when he's freed, Noel is working to keep him east, because that would be a huge propaganda coup for Moscow if two Field brothers stayed east. And then the way he tries to lure Erica to the east, even after she's freed from the gulag, and as a result, Erica doesn't ever see him again. And on his deathbed, Noel Field asks for her. This is a very kind of poignant moment, and she later, Erica later, said that she deeply regretted that she didn't answer that call, because he had been a good father to her, So again, the complexity of the man, but I enjoy writing about complex characters. They make for much more interesting material, I think.
Sean, right here.
Hi, Katty.
Hi.
Augusto, I met you on Saturday at the Politics and Prose.
Nice
I grew up with Erica Wallach, and for me she was a heroine. I'm a psychologist, I work with the military, and
it's very nice that you came.
When I think of self-actualization, there's two people that come to mind, and one's my granddad, who was a politician in Peru, and the other one's Erica Wallach. She really lived life to the fullest. There was no manipulating her. She told you exactly what it was, and she was just a fearsome force to have around.
Yeah.
Demanded respect from everybody and was loved by so many people. I was with her as she passed away after college, and really left quite an impact on me for my life. And we actually did visit the Fields home outside of Boston when I was a teenager. I keep wondering, what would Erica Wallach say if she was here listening to this lecture?
I wish she were here.
And I wonder, I mean, there's always been a lot of questions in my mind, such as, would we classify her as a spy if she was working closely with Noah Field, delivering documents or helping out in a cause? That's always been a question in my mind. And I'm also very interested in the her early relationship with Noah Field, how they got in, you know, how he met her and how that worked out. And her marrying this army captain.
Yes.
The army captain, you know, was doing well, but people in the family were pretty well placed. And I wonder if this was also a political move, if Noah Field encouraged it or was considering using that as getting further classified information and other things.
He hated it, didn't he? Yeah.
Noah Field was very upset when his beloved foster daughter fell in love with an American GI. That was not part of his program. He saw a brilliant future for her as a communist. And indeed, she did join the party. And the Communist Party of Germany was a legal party, just as the American Communist Party was a legal party. But, you know, the whole question of what is spying and what constitutes espionage is a murky area. And, for example, my father was convicted as a spy, which he was not. He was a journalist. But as I studied his record, there were areas where he crossed a line in because he so believed that in the Cold War game, the West was on the right side. And therefore, he did, in fact, take a document from the Hungarian parliament and gave it to the American ambassador. And he was seen doing that. And a document that wasn't meant to be removed from the premises. So that can constitute espionage, but I think it's I like to think that espionage is when you're a professional and you are working, you are not just helping a cause that you feel is the right side, but you're actually working. Now, mind you, Noel Field was never paid for anything he did. Neither was Alger his. His reward was from another source. His reward was feeling that he was a comrade. It meant so much to him to be called comrade, and in the end, his greatest reward was his funeral, which they gave him a state funeral with full military honors, and he was buried alongside the heroes of the Hungarian Communist Movement. And by the way, later he was moved to a far more modest spot, but he had that, and he had prescribed that the mourners sing the hymn of the International Communist Movement, the Internationale, and I interviewed people who were at the funeral, and they all said that it was pretty embarrassing because none of us knew the words anymore, and that tells you something about how few true believers there were left by the 70s, certainly in Hungary.
I have one last part to this. I have my own theories. What did you find doing your research helped her survive those 5 years? It must have been pretty darn awful in the gulag. And I'm sure many died by suicide, and many just died of sickness and everything else. I have my own theories. I've read parts of Light at Midnight, which is Erica's book.
Yes.
But what's your theory?
I think that Erica, this will sound strange, I think she lived as full a life in the gulag as is humanly possible. She had relationships. She made friendships. She even had a romance. She was not in solitary. It was cold, and it was primitive, and it was most of us would not have endured what Erica endured, but she had a lot of fight in her, and no bitterness. In fact, when she emerged, I had the privilege of knowing Nelson Mandela, and Mandela did not have a shred of bitterness toward his captors, towards the people who for 27 years, I believe, kept him from living a life. And neither did Erica. On the contrary, she, as you know, she considered it a sort of a blessing that she had been through that, because it gave life that followed an extra zest for her. And she had such an appetite, as you know better than I do, she had such an appetite for life after that. She did not live a single day without thinking, wow, I am so lucky to be alive. And she considered that a gift. So, you know, people approach events differently. And for one person, that's a reason for despair. And for another, it's, wow, I know the meaning and the value and the gift of life.
She would tell me a story about her love of animals, and how she would take care of the ants and bugs in her cell. And she got out of prison, she was heading the SPCA in Warrenton, Virginia, which was one of her jobs. So this love of animal was kind of sublimated. How can I take care of others?
Yes, what a great role model Erica is. For me, she really was the highlight of my research, because she was such a positive person. And there's interest in from some Hollywood film people in making this a movie, and I think Erica makes the movie. If there is a movie, because Noel Field is not exactly an uplifting character.
Any further questions? We had time for one last one over here. Shauna, right in front. Yeah.
I got three really quick questions. Mm. And another if you have time otherwise, but it sounds like not. PBS just aired the Ken Burns documentary on the Sharps last night. Did they know the Fields?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Part of the same outfit, the Unitarians.
I didn't see them in the book, or did I miss that?
They featured in my research, but they did not have direct interaction. But they were part of the Unitarians that Field completely deceived about his purpose, which of course was saving communists. The Sharps were genuine humanitarians. They were there to save lives. And Noel Field subverted their mission.
Did you, you talked about the interview your parents had with the Fields. Do you actually have the records of that? Do they have notebooks?
Not notebooks, but my father had terrible handwriting, so he always typed everything up. So I had his typed notes. And also, over the years, we had conversations.
You started this by describing a day Field picks up the newspapers in 1948 and sees his name plastered in the Hiss case proceedings or stories. Was that an actual event just out of curiosity?
It was.
It's recorded that
he
saw that.
Yes, in a letter.
Time for one
second. Go, those are good, quick. Yeah.
Yeah.
Unless the next one is the meaning of life or something.
No,
which we'll talk about afterwards.
Yeah. I should disclaim, I'm a grandchild of Whitaker Chambers, so this is
Oh, you're David.
Particular, right.
Oh, nice to meet you, David.
Good to meet you.
Oh.
The assassination of Ignaz Reiss.
Yes. Which Noel Field was willing to participate in.
And I thought you clearly documented that. You did mention Walter Kravitzky as well.
Yes.
You used the term something like passively complicit for Noel Field in the assassination.
Yes.
Would you consider that Walter Kravitzky was also at least passively complicit? Because there are variations on whether or not he was at all even willing or of the how knowing a participant he was.
Yeah, Walter, General Kravitzky, who of course had a famous meeting with your grandfather, right. which was critical for both of them. I cut Kravitzky a whole lot of slack because he was running for his life, and he decided based on the order to assassinate Ignaz Reiss for the crime of being a good Bolshevik, a good Leninist, as opposed to a good Stalinist, he considered that a deal breaker, and he was trying, as your grandfather, Whitaker Chambers, successfully managed, to break with Stalinism, with Stalin. And it worked for your grandfather, but it didn't work for Kravitzky. He was found shot right here in Washington in a hotel.
A few blocks near, away.
Yes, near Union Station. I have a lot of respect for Kravitzky, who was yet another disappointed Bolshevik who Stalin simply could not tolerate. Because Stalin was about something else. Stalin was about Stalin.
Yeah.
And not a world communist movement, which is what your grandfather and Kravitzky and so many others in my book were about. Arthur Kessler and Orwell, etc.
Please join me in thanking Kadi Marton for taking the time to join us today.
We'd like to thank our great sponsor, Mack Weldon, for continuing to support SpyCast. Remember, you can get 20% off at MackWeldon.com by using the promo code SpyCast. That's 20% off at MackWeldon.com. Use the promo code SpyCast. Thank you for joining us on SpyCast. Every Tuesday, we'll give you the most interesting conversations with some of the most intriguing people in the world of intelligence. If you'd like to send us a comment or suggestion, you can email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Or tweet us at @intlspycast. That's intlspycast. The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit institution. To help support future educational programming, please visit spymuseum.org and click on our Donate Now link at the top of the page. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.